Hi, I'm Jocelyn Beal.
Hello, everyone. I am Dominique Mariso.
Hi, I'm Chisa Hutchinson.
Hi, this is Lynn Nottage, and you're listening to the Call and Response podcast.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the final episode of Season 3 for the Call and Response podcast. And I truly cannot believe we have finally made it to the end of Season 3. And I say that not because I didn't think I had the stamina or because there's enough Black artists to interview, because honestly, we have barely scratched the surface, but because these three seasons have gone by so quickly. This one in particular, I feel like, flew by. Each season, just, they've been so full of love, full of healing, and full of talent. I am so grateful and honored I have been able to witness the magic of these artists up close, and I'm so grateful to you, the listeners, for showing your love and support. This podcast is bigger than me, and I'm just so happy to be a vessel for which these stories are documented and amplified. And because y'all know I love a full circle moment, I made sure that our season 3 finale guest was extra special. We began this season with Jocelyn Bio, a brilliant Black female playwright who is just launching into superstardom right now, and someone I consider an artistic influence on me at this point. And to complete the season, we finished with Lynn Nottage. I'm saying 2-time Pulitzer Prize winner, like making history out here, y'all. Another brilliant Black female playwright, and one of the first that I was introduced to, who has maintained a decades-long career that continues to break ceilings and influence so many artists. And you'll hear me gush about it in the episode, but I was introduced to her work in college, and I just felt so seen, and I know we say represented a lot these days, but represented, like it was so exciting to see a Black woman be a playwright. I could really go on and on. I mean, this woman, like, she's the reason I wanted to get into dramaturgy and like theater history and critical race theory, all of these different things. And so anyway, so I was so excited to be able to sit down with her. I was nervous, I'm not going to lie. So several times I say Secret Life of the Bees, when in fact the title is Secret Life of Bees. So please forgive me and just understand that if you were sitting across from Lynn Nottage, you might do it too. and you may be thinking, Felicia, season 3 is now over. What am I supposed to do all summer? Well, besides re-listening to all your favorite episodes, you can get out and get down with your Gold Star app, because there are so many events out there and so many affordable prices, so you can make this summer a memorable one. You can explore theater, comedy shows, sports, booze cruises, concerts, and so much more. So download Gold Star and let's make some memories, y'all. I know every week I'm like, I'm so hyped, I'm so thrilled, I'm so excited to introduce this week's guest, and that is completely true every time. However, this takes the cake. This is someone who has influenced my work as a theater artist and as someone in the industry. I'm absolutely floored that I get to talk with her today. She needs no introduction, but in the intro, I shall say, she is a 2-time Pulitzer Prize winner, a MAC Genius Grant recipient, an Audelco winner, Obie Award winner, Lortel winner, Drama Desk, OCC, Susan Smith Blackburn, Tony nominated play. I could keep going on and on, but I will just say I am sitting with Lynn Nottage, y'all. Give it up. Hi.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for being here. I really appreciate it because I know you're a busy lady. Okay. We've got Secret Life of the Bees going on at Atlantic Theater if y'all have not heard. But I want to talk to you about your craft as a playwright, because like I was saying earlier, you are so influential to so many of us, and I remember the first work of yours that I learned about was Crumbs from the Table of Joy, and I did like a dramaturgy project on it, and then I got to work on Intimate Apparel, and it's just like, you're a pioneer to me, a trailblazer. Do you feel like that, you resonate with that title?
I appreciate it. I don't always feel like a trailblazer because there's so many other playwrights who I looked up to on my journey, you know, like Intasaki Shange, who we just most recently lost, and August Wilson, and certainly Lorraine Hansberry. So I feel that I'm very much in the wake of other insurgent writers who showed me how to do it.
Yeah, absolutely. How did you get involved into performing arts and writing?
That's a really complicated, long It's a complicated question with a long response. I think that my interest in arts really began with parents who were deeply invested in showing me Black art. You know, from the time I was 5 years old, I went to see theater. I went to hear music. I was taken to museums, and in particular with a focus on African American art, because that's the time that I grew up in which they wanted me to be exposed to images and ideas that were in conversation with who I am.
Right.
And so I think that that's where my journey began. But in terms of where I began as an artist, I went to the High School of Music and Art, which is LaGuardia, as a musician. And so there was a period of time where I thought that the journey I was going to take was going to be as a musician. But it ended up leading me into theater.
Gotcha.
And I discovered that I really enjoyed making theater, I think, in high school.
Yeah.
When I wrote my first play.
Yeah. That's what I was going to ask. What was the first time you felt like you identified as a playwright?
Well, I don't think I identified as a playwright until I was in my late 20s, early 30s, because I think for a very long time I thought playwriting is just going to be a hobby because I'm never going to make a living doing this. So it's, you know, it was this passion that I nurtured, that I love, but I thought it's never going to give back. And so in some ways, and I tell this to my students, that putting the language of being a playwright into your mouth makes you a playwright. And it's something that I discovered really late in the game, is that just saying I'm a playwright meant that I was a playwright. But I remember being at dinner parties and people say, what do you do? I always circumvented that word because I thought, oh, am I a playwright if I'm not being produced yet?
Wow.
And once I said I am a playwright, ironically, I think I began being produced.
Yeah, claiming that space.
Yes, claiming that space.
That identity.
Yeah.
Who were some of the writers as you were beginning to, you know, navigate your own journey through playwriting that you were looking up to and reading?
Well, you know, I think I mentioned earlier some of the playwrights who certainly I came of age at a time when Intasaki Shange's For Colored Girls was on the landscape, and suddenly we as Black women were able to occupy the Broadway stage, and that was huge to see. And I also came of age at a time when August Wilson was on the landscape. I went to the Yale School of Drama, and one of his artistic homes was Yale Rep, and so I had the privilege of being able to watch him not only develop plays, but to work on some plays. I worked on Piano Lesson. I was a dresser, and I was a stagehand.
Wow.
And I watched how he made that play. And I think it's really interesting because we always assume that a play arrives perfectly.
Yeah.
And when you see August Wilson's work, it feels perfect. But I saw that as an artist, that there was this evolution. The very first performance of Piano Lesson, I think it ran 4.5 hours.
Wow.
And when the curtain went up, half the audience was gone. And then I watched him watch the audience and begin to hone and find his story.
Yeah.
During previews.
Oh, yeah, during that process.
Yeah.
I feel like it's a very key process.
Yeah.
And so what is the writing process for Lynn Nottage as you sit down to dive into a play?
I think that every play for me, it comes in a different way. You know, I can speak for plays like Ruined and Sweat, which were research-based. I spent 2.5 years just diving into those particular, in the case of Ruined, I was telling the story of women in Congo who were victims of gender-specific human rights abuse. It's a topic that I had to research because I didn't know what was happening there. It was not an experience that's sort of indigenous to who I am. And so it took 2 years to really understand what was happening to women in Congo. And in Sweat, it was a play that was commissioned by the Oregon Shakespeare Festival as part of their American history cycle. And I wanted to look at deindustrialization as a form of revolution, because it's a massive change in America. And so for me, that required going to a city and trying to understand how is deindustrialization changing the American narrative. And so those plays had a very specific process, which was heavily research-based, you know, and the research was a form of intense procrastination, but also of learning. But then I have other plays like Fabulation, which I didn't want to research. I just wanted to write something that came very quickly. And the exercise for me was, how can you write a play that feels just like one exhale? You know, you breathe in and then you breathe out. And that's what fabulation was. I tried to write it as quickly as possible and let my imagination go wherever it took me.
Totally.
Which is why it's sort of fun and irreverent and very different stylistically than the other plays that I've written.
And that's super interesting to hear you talk about the differences between those two. And you touched on them a bit when you were referring to August Wilson's process. But do you have an audience in mind when you're writing, or is it just for you when you're writing it?
I think when I was writing Intimate Apparel, mm-hmm. I wrote that play very specifically for my mother. And so I was thinking about a woman her age mm-hmm. when I wrote that play. When I wrote Fabulation, I was just thinking, what would make my friends laugh?
Yeah.
What makes me laugh? And when I was writing Sweat, I was writing for a much broader audience because I want everyone to see it. I felt like this is a play that I want to be in dialogue with audiences across America.
Totally. When I feel like your shows too, or your scripts, your plays, they're about a specific experience, and yet from my experiences with them as an audience member, people of all different, you know, races, genders, whatever, identities can tap into something universal that speaks to them.
Well, you know, hopefully all good theater is universal. Mm-hmm. You know, I think that if you're telling a story that's honest and truthful, I think that anyone can relate to it.
And they'll find their own thread that they follow. They'll find their way
into that story. I mean, I think that stories that don't tell the truth are the stories that we have a problem with.
Oh, that's good. I hope y'all are taking notes from Lynn Nodded, y'all. Well, and so you'd been forging a path, you know, in a career as a playwright. What was that moment like to receive that Pulitzer?
Well, winning the Pulitzer for Ruin, first of all, came as a big surprise because, number one, it's a play that's not about America. I mean, it's certainly about the world filtered through an American sensibility because uh-huh. that's who I am. And so I had no expectation that I was going to win. Yeah. So when I got the phone call, it literally took my breath away.
Wow. Wow.
And I was immensely excited and surprised. And then once I had an opportunity to let that sink in, that I've won this enormous prize, I felt a certain sense of validation because I have been in this game for so long and I've been working so hard. And as a playwright, you don't work for a tremendous amount of money. Mm-hmm. And the reward you have is finding your audience. And what to me the Pulitzer meant is that perhaps my work would find a larger audience. And so that felt very gratifying.
Yeah.
Is that Ruined would have a larger reach than the rest of my work mm-hmm. and open up doors.
Totally.
You know, not just for me, but for other African-American women who are writing.
Right. Was the goal always then Broadway, I guess, when you committed to a career in playwriting?
You know, for me, Broadway was never the mm-hmm. end game, and it still is not the end game for me mm-hmm. because Broadway isn't as accessible as it should be. Mm. You know, the tickets are so expensive,
right.
Which means that there are only, you know, people who can go for birthdays
yeah,
and for anniversaries.
Right. But
you want the work to be seen by everybody. So mm. my goal as a playwright is to figure out ways in which I can take my theater beyond Broadway.
Totally. And like Intimate Apparel, I was reading, is one of the most produced plays in America. And I was
it continues,
yes,
which is, you know, you talk about surprises.
Right.
You know, and that was a play. You talk about telling the truth. I mean, that's a play which is about a very simple thing, which is love.
Mm.
And it's, you know, it's about unrequited love.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
And the assumption was that it wouldn't have a life. And it's had just this kind of incredible life. And now it's going to be an opera.
Right.
At Lincoln Center next season, which is wonderful.
Yeah.
But you talk about a play that has had a surprising audience.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it's not just an audience here, but it's an international audience.
Absolutely.
And it's never been on Broadway.
And isn't that interesting? Because I feel like oftentimes in the mainstream that Broadway is considered the pinnacle, but you can be completely successful, however you want to define success, without having massive amounts of Broadway shows or whatever.
You know, hey, you can be successful as a playwright and not have a show in New York City now.
There you go.
You know, there are playwrights who have careers in Chicago and mm-hmm. Seattle and in Los Angeles and Philadelphia and all over the country who've never been produced in New York.
Yeah.
You know, I think that sometimes we're incredibly myopic about what success is mm-hmm. and how it can be defined.
Right, yeah. Well, and you touched on Intimate Apparel becoming an opera. I wanted to hear about that experience and, of course, talk about Secret Life of Bees because these are musicalized shows or musicals. And you have a background in music. So yes. What has that experience been like for you?
Well, it's been really fun. First talking about intimate apparel, I'm working with composer Ricky Ian mm-hmm. Gordon. And for a number of years, we've admired each other's work. And we're trying to figure out how we could work together.
Yeah.
And we actually spent 2 years like reading material and listening to things before we decided we wanted to do intimate apparel.
Oh,
and
wow.
He said to me secretly, you know, I really want to do intimate apparel as an opera. And I said to him, it's like, oh my God, I can't believe you said that because that's what I want to do. And he's like, we've wasted 2 years.
Oh, no.
But then we began, and it's in that relationship has been wonderful. Sort of adapting my play into a libretto was not as easy as I thought it would be.
Oh, why not?
And well, it's just completely different muscles. The first libretto that I adapted, I gave it to Ricky. He said, you've rewritten your play. I wrote it a second time. He's like, you still rewritten your play. A third time, you've rewritten your play. And then finally, he took me aside and he explained to me, he's like, you're not trusting your collaborator. That opera and in musicals, and this is something that I took with me when I was adapting Secret Life of Bees, mm-hmm. is that music is more expansive. It can express the interiority of characters, and you don't have to work so hard to make people understand what the emotional core of the work is.
Oh.
And so he said, let me help you and pull back 50%. And once I understood that, I was able then to rewrite the libretto and lean very heavily on him.
Yeah. Wow. That is an interesting, like you said, a different muscle to exercise.
It's a completely different muscle.
And then when it came to Secret Life of Bees, what was the adaptation process of something that wasn't your work and musicalizing that?
And it's A Secret Life of Bees is a book that I remember reading like years ago,
right.
when it was like an Oprah.
Yeah,
I think it was
like
the very first Oprah book pick.
Oh, was it?
I think so.
Wow.
I think it was the very first
Shout
one
out
that
to
I read
Oprah.
It. And I really enjoyed it and found it to be somewhat unusual in part because it's a story about that is centered around a 14-year-old white girl.
Right.
Who has an abusive father, who has a mother who she accidentally killed, and she has tremendous guilt about that, and mm-hmm. who runs away and finds herself in the hive of these black women who nurture and take care of her. And one of the things that drew me to the material is just so often you see movies and stories that are about the white savior.
Uh-huh.
In which, you know, a black body is in a white space in which the white person saves them. And I thought, here's a very unusual story in which you have a white girl who enters into the black space, and she has to learn about the civil rights movement and learn about what it means to be black in 1964.
Mm-hmm.
And through encountering blackness, she's able to find herself, you know, because she's someone who's lived a marginalized life because of her circumstances. She comes into a space where there are people collectively who've been marginalized and who've made this beautiful life,
right,
and who are this complete community, and she sees that they're thriving and she's welcomed into that.
Yeah. And I like, because listeners, I got to see it a couple weeks ago, but what I liked about it too, specifically about those characters, is they welcome her in, but they also like keep it real with her,
you know
what I mean? They're like, we're not going to pretend that everything's all smelled like roses. Like, there are real hardships that we're going through, and you need to respect that.
Right, which I think is part of the storytelling. It's 1964, and we cannot circumvent the fact that it was very difficult for African Americans to live in the South, and that it was in the midst of a massive, important civil rights movement.
Yeah. What have the rehearsals been like? Working with LaShawn's, like Issa Davis, all those folks.
Yeah, I mean, LaShawn's, Issa Davis, Saycon.
Right.
We've been incredibly blessed to have like some of the best singers in the game and some of the best actresses, and it's just been absolute joy.
Yeah.
I mean, they just bring enthusiasm, but also one of the things that I want to point out is that they're super smart and they're constantly interrogating not just the text, but also the music, and like you talk about keeping it real, is that they've been part of keeping this process real.
Yeah.
You know, because we all have our hesitations about telling this kind of story, particularly now, and we want to find a way into telling a story about, I'm speaking for myself as a black woman, it's like, how do I tell the story about a young white girl who's going through trauma at a time when an entire black race has been traumatized?
Wow. Yeah. But I think you, yeah, and you so, were the person that had to do it. Do you
and
know
so,
I mean?
Yeah, and so I think that that was part of, you know, you talk about an art problem, the exercise, and that was our exercise,
you know,
and also leaning on the book, because the book is very beautiful. And I think that Sue Monk Kidd was aware of some of this conundrum when she was writing the book. Yeah. And in part, I think this is why she wrote the book.
And you bring up an interesting point that I chatted with Chisa about, which was this idea of when we're approaching diversity, representation, inclusion in theater, you know, some people are like, oh, colorblind casting, color conscious casting, stick a black person on stage and call it a day. And she's like, no, I'm so tired of that. I want to be telling inherently black stories about the black experience. Yeah. But I think what you're referring to too, about the rehearsal room, it's important to have black people on the creative team.
I think it's essential. And when we were putting this together, we were very mindful of how we assembled our team. We wanted it to be multicultural, because this is a multicultural story.
For sure.
And so it's essential that all of the voices that are on stage be represented off stage as well.
Yeah. And so with, we kind of talked about this earlier, if you have someone in mind when you're writing, but I think a big conversation that's been happening lately, at least like on social media, is black writers versus white critics, you know, because it's, when you're putting out a piece that white critics might not understand, what are the implications of that? And I was curious.
You know, I mean, I think it's a struggle. It's not just black critics. White critics reviewing black work. It's white male critics reviewing black women's work or women's work who don't necessarily have the tools necessary to understand the complexity of what we're saying.
Right.
Because they have their own filter through which they're viewing this, which is not necessarily the same as my filter.
Right.
And it's frustrating.
Yeah.
You know, and we are trying to take steps. There's a new magazine that we're trying to launch called Three Views. Which in the title is embedded Three Views, to offer a multitude of perspectives when looking at the work.
Yeah.
Because I think there's so much of what we create that doesn't take the full journey because the people who are reviewing don't understand the complexity of what we're trying to write.
Right.
And so I think, you know, it's really important that we have critics, and not just reviewers, but cultural critics that are able to grapple with the complexity of our ideas and who understand why we're telling our stories in the way that we tell them.
And the context of it.
And the context,
you know?
Yes.
Did you see Don't Bother Me, I Can't Cope?
I did.
Yeah, I was thinking about that, whole conversation during that, because I was like, she was doing this in the 70s, and it's still so relevant today.
It's incredibly relevant. You know, and you look at Mickey Grant, who's this great composer and one of the few black composers who've been able to stay in the game as long as she has, but she still hasn't gotten the recognition that she deserves because her work has been marginalized by the critics.
Do you feel restricted by that, or do you just say, F the haters, I'm gonna do my thing?
I think my answer to that is both.
Okay.
You know, it's like I do what I do regardless of what they have to say, but I do feel restricted by it because their opinions matter to many people who make the decisions about where our art goes, how our art is received, and and so I mean, and that's, you know, that's the paradox, and that's the frustration. I wish it didn't matter.
But we have to be at least aware of
it. You know, we have to be aware of it. But they're not going to stop me from writing what I write.
That's right. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
And there's a quote that I've actually learned a long time ago, but it comes back to me periodically, and it's by Basquiat, and it was, I don't want to be called a black artist, I just want to be an artist.
Yeah.
And I'm just curious of your thoughts on that, if you agree with that or not, because I think there's several layers,
you know,
to it.
The only time that I really resent labels is when they restrict me.
Like we were just saying.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, if someone wants to call me a black artist, I am happy to be called a black artist because I am a black artist.
Right.
You know,
right.
If they want to call me a black woman artist, I'm happy. But the minute they begin using that in a way to restrict what I do is when I resent it.
Right. When they're trying to box
you in. When they're boxing me in, or when, you know, yeah. When they're trying to diminish the work or marginalize the work, I resent it.
Yeah.
But I have no problems with the label because that label is representative of who I am.
And it's in, inherent to your work,
it's inherent
too.
To my work. It's fun. Yeah.
Well, and I want to talk about that, too, because you were a playwright in residence at Signature Theater.
Yes.
And so you got to revisit some of your work with some amazing black women lead characters.
Yes.
And so what was
and directors.
And directors.
And directors.
Hey. Yeah, what was that experience like revisiting those pieces?
You know, it's always terrifying to revisit old friends because I didn't know whether the work was going to hold up because they were written at very specific moments in my life when I felt like this is what I needed to say. And it was fun.
Yeah.
It was fun to see how the actresses enjoyed inhabiting, you know, the roles of Undine and of Vera Stark and how they still felt very fresh and contemporary and relevant.
Good.
And so that was really refreshing for me to see.
And you got to choose the pieces,
correct? I got to choose. I really wanted to do the comedies, particularly now. And you look at the landscape of the African-American work that was presented this year, so much of it was dealing with black trauma. And it's
so
not
true.
And it's not that this doesn't deal with black trauma, but it deals with it in a very different way. And I felt like I just need to laugh.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like I'm living the truth every single day. I'm reading the newspapers. And I think that we as black people occasionally need places to escape.
Yeah.
And laughter is medicinal.
Yes, absolutely. It can still pack a punch.
It can pack a punch, but it's medicinal.
What, how do you think your artistry's changed since you wrote those for the first time?
Gosh, well, I didn't write Vera Stark that long ago. I mean, Fabulation certainly was a while ago. That's hard for me to say how it's changed. I think that I probably need more critical distance and able to process that question. I think that certainly from when I wrote Fabulation at the same time I was writing Ruined, and I was writing, No, I wrote Fabulation when I was writing Into Bene Pera. I wrote Vera Stark when I was writing Ruined.
Okay.
Because
you write plays.
I write them, companions.
Yeah,
Yeah, I don't know. I can't answer that question. I don't have enough critical distance.
Once you actually were in the process and getting it up on its feet in the rehearsal room, did you feel like, I'm happy to be revisiting these works.
I loved revisiting them.
Yeah.
I love being back in rehearsal. I love that some of the moments which I thought were funny 10 years ago were still very funny.
Right.
You know, there were little nips and tucks that had to be made. Mm. You know, for instance, it was like one of the laugh lines back then was Epilady, and Epilady no longer exists. People were still using answering machines when I wrote Fabulation, and that didn't exist. So some of those things were updated,
right?
And it was fun to find contemporary equivalents,
totally,
and see if I could find punchlines.
Those new little moments. And I got to hear you speak at the Park Avenue Armory. I guess it was in September that Brandon Jacob Jenkins and Jocelyn Bia hosted, and you said something that really struck a chord with me. Of that, these days, people seem to be in a first draft culture.
Yeah, I mean, the thing that worries me, and I don't know whether it's because of Instagram and Facebook, and that people want results quickly and they want to discover a new star immediately.
Mm.
And so I feel like every season there's this rush to put something fresh and new on.
Mm-hmm.
And I think in some ways some writers and directors are sort of rushed too quickly out of the oven.
Yeah, right.
And don't have the identity to really sort of fully nurture their voice and understand who they are. And I just fear for some folks.
Yeah.
In that the work is not ready to be seen yet. And it's not a criticism of the work because, you know, another draft or two and it will be brilliant, but I feel sometimes that there's this need to rush things out too quickly.
Right. So I guess for folks that are listening that are aspiring writers, do you have thoughts or advice of how to kind of really massage it in and do those revisions?
Well, I think for young writers, I think there's always the fear that if I don't take this opportunity, I will never have an opportunity again.
Oh, interesting, yeah.
And rather than taking the time to really nurture and sit in the work, they rush it out. And I would say trust the talent.
The process, yeah.
And trust the, trust the process. Well, the process now is to get something out quickly. So I would not trust that process.
Okay,
I would say trust your talent, trust your instincts, you know, and don't release your work before you're ready to release it.
Yeah.
Into the world. And also don't allow someone to direct you in a path that you're not comfortable going.
Mm-hmm. And I was curious about that too, in a slightly different way of like when it comes to collaborations of working with a director,
right.
What is it like forming that relationship of massaging the play with a director?
You know, I've been very fortunate that early on I've worked with some fabulous directors who've been good friends and directors like Surette Scott, who was the very first director who I worked with, who she'd been in this business for a long time, and she really became a mentor and a guide and someone who I could look to help me negotiate this process. Because when you first enter a theater, you don't know what to do.
Right.
I mean, I certainly didn't. It's like, I don't know how to talk to the designer. I don't know how to talk to the dramaturg and the artistic director. And I really needed someone to help me negotiate that process.
Mm-hmm.
And then I was also fortunate to early in my career, meet director Kate Worski, who became a longtime collaborator.
Yeah.
And what we realized is that we had this shared vocabulary.
Oh.
And that I could use a shorthand with her that put me immediately at ease. And I knew that what I saw was what she saw.
That's helpful.
Yeah, and that was super helpful.
Yeah. So the last two questions to wrap up the podcast are ones that I ask every time.
Yeah.
One, if you could recommend a piece of Black art, whether that's, you know, a musical, a book, a TV show that you'd recommend our listeners take
sure.
in.
I mean, you know, I get fixated on things, and I'm fixated right now on two Black female artists. One is Vanessa Germain, who makes these beautiful sculptures, and a lot of it is about healing of the Black body.
Okay,
and if you have an opportunity, just Google her work. It's absolutely beautiful. And then the other person who I feel I'm very much in conversation is with right now is LaToya Ruby Frazier, who is a photographer who documents deindustrialization and small towns. And the first time I saw her work, I thought, oh my God, her work is sort of a representation of what I want to do.
Mm-hmm.
And she's so brilliant, and she's and she's so smart.
Mm-hmm.
And that I recommend seeing her work.
Well, so my second question was if you could give a shout out to a fellow Black artist, but I think those are the shout outs. Look at Lynn Nottage doing, she's killing two birds with one stone. And if folks want to follow your journey on social media, where can they follow you at?
You can follow me at LynnNottage.com, or you can look at me up on Twitter at
you have a great Twitter.
Lynn Brooklyn.
Yeah, I love your Twitter. I'm always, me and my mom are always sitting here tweeting, like, ah, go Lynn. And then if folks want to buy tickets to Secret Life of Bees, they go to AtlanticTheater.org. And they have a Today Ticks lottery that you can get involved in. Well, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you.
And spending time with us. You guys, this is the finale episode of Season 3, so we will be back. And in the meantime, why don't you subscribe to us on iTunes, leave a review, rate us, follow us on social media, Call and Response NYC on Instagram, Facebook, and Tumblr, Call Response NYC on Twitter, and until season 4, y'all.